You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 3, entitled Karma in Relation to Health and Illness, given in Hamburg on the 18th of May, 1910. What we shall deal with now and in the next few days could give rise to misunderstandings. I will speak about certain questions of illness and health from the point of view of karma. And as present-day views on this subject diverge so widely, there is a certain risk that the fundamental ideas of spiritual science will be misunderstood when the relationship of illness and health with karma is discussed. You are surely aware of the intensity and passion with which questions of health and illness are discussed in the widest circles. You will all be familiar with the opposition voiced by non-experts, as well as certain members of the medical profession, against what is called scientific medicine. On the other hand, it is obvious that the representatives of scientific medicine frequently feel challenged by many an unjustified attack to do more than defend the scientific point of view with passion. Some of them have embarked on a real battle against whatever may be put forward on the subject of health and illness from any angle different from that of official medicine. Anthroposophy or spiritual science will only do justice to its great tasks if it succeeds in maintaining an unprejudiced and objective judgment in questions like this, where a great deal of confusion is created by endless discussions. Anyone who has attended similar lectures of mine will know how little I am inclined to join in the chorus of those who wish to discredit what is called conventional medicine. Spiritual science is very far from wishing to join any particular body of opinion. Allow me to take this opportunity to stress right from the beginning that the factual accomplishments and research efforts of recent years and decades, particularly in the field of human illness and health, are worthy of praise, recognition, and admiration, as are numerous other endeavors of natural science. And concerning what has actually been achieved in this field, I may also say that if anyone has reason to rejoice over what has been achieved by medicine in recent years, it is spiritual science. However, it must be equally emphasized, and this applies to natural science in particular, that the achievements, the actual knowledge gained, and the discoveries which are made are rarely interpreted and explained satisfactorily by present-day scientific opinion. This is a striking feature of many spheres of scientific research today. The opinions and theories which are put forward do not match up to the objective facts, some of which are miraculous. Only the light of spiritual science will bring a clear understanding of what has been achieved in this field in recent years. It should be quite clear now that we are not in the slightest concerned with joining any paltry opposition to present endeavors in scientific medicine. At the same time, it must be pointed out that the admirable facts which have come to light will not be able to bear fruit for the good of mankind in our time because they are rendered fruitless by today's materialistic opinions and theories. For this reason, it is far more appropriate for anthroposophy unpretentiously to say what needs to be said than to engage in any sort of party squabble. Such an approach will at least not ignite matters any further. To reach any point of view at all from which to consider the questions before us, we need to be clear about the fact that the causes of any phenomenon must be researched in a great variety of ways. Some are close, others very remote. And when the karmic causes of health-related matters are researched by means of anthroposophy, it is the more remote causes, those which are not right on the surface, which we need to look at primarily. I will give you a comparison which will make things clearer. If you think it through, you will certainly discover what I mean. Let us assume that someone took the view, quote, how splendidly we have advanced in this field today, close quote, while patently ignoring all the previous century's research on health and illness. If you attempted to form some kind of general view of what is said about health and illness today, you would find something like this view prevailing among the experts. What has emerged in this field in the last 20 or 30 years is a kind of absolute truth, which may be expanded, but could most certainly never be refuted or judged negatively, as is most of what human endeavor had previously brought to light in the discipline concerned. Such judgments, unfortunately, often being pronounced by the proclaimers of the new truth. So, it is said, for example, quote, especially in this field there was gross superstition in the olden days, close quote. And this is followed by frightening examples of how people attempted to heal this or that complaint in previous centuries. Such judgments become even more extreme when expressions are found in some context or other whose original meaning is no longer available to modern-day consciousness, but which have, nevertheless, crept into it. For example, someone might say, quote, there were times when every illness was attributed to God or the devil, close quote. Things were not as bad as such people make out because they have no idea of the complex ideas encapsulated in expressions such as God or devil. The following example will illustrate this. Let us assume that two people are talking to each other. One says to the other, quote, I have just seen a room full of flies. Someone said it was quite natural the room should be full of flies, and I thought so too, for the room was very dirty, and so the flies thrive. Close quote. Quote again, it really makes sense to consider this the reason for the existence of flies, and I, too, believe that the one who says that the flies will not be in the room once it is cleaned thoroughly is right. Close quote. But now another person comes along and says that he knows another reason why so many flies were in the room, and that the real cause was that a bone-idle housewife had lived there for a long time. Now, what boundless superstition to think that idleness is like a kind of person who only needs to beckon and in come the flies. Surely the other explanation, which attributes the presence of flies to the dirt, is more correct. The case is similar in an altogether different context when it is said, quote, someone has fallen ill as a result of being infected by some sort of bacillus. If this is driven out, he will be well again. Close quote. But now there are others who speak of some kind of spiritual cause that lies deeper down. Surely all one needs to do is drive out the bacillus. To speak of a spiritual cause of illness while admitting all the rest is no more superstitious than considering a bone-idle housewife to be the cause of the presence of flies. And there is no need to be angry if someone says that the flies would not be there if the room were clean. It is not a question of one view being in opposition to the other. It is more important to try and understand each other's point of view and intention. One must carefully take into consideration whether only the immediate causes are spoken of, or whether indirect causes are referred to. The objective anthroposophist will never take the standpoint that laziness needs only to beckon for the flies to come into the room. He will know that other material things also come into consideration. Everything which has a material expression has its spiritual background, and for the welfare of humanity, this spiritual background has to be sought. Those, however, who would rather join the battle of arguments should also be reminded that spiritual causes are highly differentiated and also cannot be combated in the same way as ordinary material causes. It would also be wrong to think that fighting the spiritual causes obviates the need to fight the material causes, for then one might allow the room to remain dirty and only seek to cure the idleness of the housewife. Looking at karma, we have to consider the connection between events that happened earlier in a person's life and their effect on the same person at a later time. In relation to health and illness, from the point of view of karma, that means nothing but this. Can we connect the healthy and diseased condition with the former deeds and experiences of this person, and how will his present condition of health or disease later react upon him? Nowadays, people would far rather believe that illnesses connected only with immediate causes. For the fundamental tendency in the modern view of life is to seek always what is most convenient. And it is certainly convenient to go no further than the immediate cause. Therefore, especially in relation to illness, only the immediate causes are taken into consideration. And this applies most of all to those afflicted with the illness. For it cannot be denied that the patients themselves are led to take this standpoint, and because of this there exists so much dissatisfaction when there is a belief that the disease must have an immediate cause which must be found by the skilled physician. If he cannot help, he is accused of having bungled somehow. From this convenient method of judgment proceeds much of what is said at the present time on this subject. If our understanding of the concept of karma really comprises its wide-ranging effects, we will gradually expand our view from the events of the present moment to those that happened a lot earlier, in relative terms. What is more important, we will know for sure that matters relating to human life cannot be properly understood unless we expand our view to encompass what happened further back in time. This applies particularly to the question of illness. When we talk about someone who is ill or healthy, for that matter, the pressing question will always be, how can we form any idea of this state of ill health? Spiritual scientific research, when applied directly and with the help of clairvoyant faculties to a phenomenon of human illness, will always note certain irregularities. These will not only be found in the physical body of the person concerned, but also in his higher members, in his etheric and astral bodies. Due to the fact that all three members can be implicated in the illness, the clairvoyant researcher will always have to consider what part the physical body, on the one hand, and the etheric and astral bodies on the other, play in the case concerned. This raises the question as to the ideas we might form about the origins of the illness. For that purpose, we need to define the actual concept of illness. There are people who like to speak of all sorts of matters in allegorical, symbolical terms, and accordingly refer to the illnesses of even minerals or metals. Hence, rust eating away at iron would be defined as a process of illness. People may think as they wish, but we must be quite clear about the fact that life cannot really be grasped fruitfully with such abstract thinking. One might arrive at some kind of playful notion of life which has nothing to do with actual facts. If we want to arrive at a proper concept of illness and indeed health, we must refrain from speaking of minerals and metals in terms of falling ill. In the plant world, however, matters are quite different. It is certainly possible to speak of plants having illnesses. Indeed, diseases of plants are of great interest and of supreme relevance when it comes to grasping the concept of illness. Leaving any playful conceptualization aside, one cannot really speak of inner causes of illness in the case of plants, as one may very well do in the case of the animal or the human being. Diseases of plants must always be traced to outer causes, to this or that detrimental effect of the earth, insufficient light, effects of the wind, and other forces of the elements and nature. Diseases of plants may furthermore be traced to the influence of parasites that attack the plants and damage them. To speak of, quote, inner causes of illness, close quote, in relation to plants is basically totally unjustified. As I do not have half a year available to speak about this subject, it is impossible for me to furnish innumerable proofs of what I have just indicated. However, the more deeply we penetrate into plant pathology, the more clearly we will understand that the concept of, quote, inner causes of illness, close quote, is simply not applicable to plants, and that their diseases are caused by outer phenomena and damaging outer influences. A plant is a being which consists of a physical body and an etheric body, and this is how we first encounter it in the outer world. At the same time, this being draws our attention to the fact, as it were, that such a being, which consists of physical and etheric body, is healthy in principle, and will only fall ill in response to an outer injury. This fully accords with the findings of spiritual science. In the case of animal or human illness, definite changes in the inner or supersensible regions of the organism may be discovered by clairvoyant research, but this will never be found in plants. In a diseased plant, it is not the original etheric body which is changed, but certain disturbances and harmful influences have forced their way into the physical body, and especially the etheric body, from outside. The results of spiritual research fully validate the general conclusion that the plant, consisting of physical body and etheric body, is, in essence, healthy. A further important aspect is the plant's capacity, on receiving outside injuries, to mobilize all kinds of defenses to safeguard its growth and development, to heal itself. Notice, for instance, how, if you cut a plant, it tries to grow around the damaged part, to bypass whatever may be obstructing and damaging it. We can almost see the plant's inner defense system, its healing power, become activated. So there is something in the plant's etheric and physical body which is capable of activating inner healing forces in response to outer injury. This is an extremely important fact to consider. A being such as a plant, consisting of etheric and physical body, not only shows us that the physical body and the etheric body have sufficient inherent health to ensure the development and growth of the being concerned, but that there is even a superabundance of such forces which can be activated for healing when external damage occurs. Where do these healing forces originate? If you wound a merely physical body, the injury will remain. It is unable of itself to repair the injury. For this reason, we cannot talk of a disease in the case of a merely physical body, and least of all, can we talk of a relation between disease and healing. This we can best see when a disease appears in a plant. Here, we have to look for the principle of the inner healing power in the etheric body. Spiritual investigation shows us this very clearly, for the activity of the etheric body of the plant is much intensified around the part where the wound has been inflicted. The etheric body produces completely different forms, then. It flows in a very different way. It is an extremely interesting fact that we challenge the etheric body of a plant to increased activity when we injure its physical body. Whilst this is not a definition of the concept of illness, it does give us an idea of the processes involved in illness, as well as of the inner nature of healing. Following the clue given by inward spiritual observation, let us go further and try to understand the external phenomena to which spiritual science leads us. Let us now consider injuries inflicted on animals, beings that have an astral body. If we carry our observations further, we shall see that the etheric body of a higher animal reacts correspondingly less to an external injury. The higher the animal is in the scale of evolution, so much the less will be the activity of the etheric body. If we cause a severe injury to the physical body of a lower or even a higher mammal, If, for instance, we tear a leg off a dog or some such animal, we find that the etheric body cannot respond with its healing power in the same measure as the etheric body of a plant responds to a similar injury to itself. But even in the animal kingdom, this activity of the etheric body can still be seen to a great extent. Let us descend to a very low order of animals, to the tritons. If we cut off certain organs from such a creature, it will not experience anything particularly painful. The organs quickly grow again, and the animal soon looks as it did before. In this case, something similar has taken place as in the case of the plant. We have called forth a certain healing power in the etheric body. But it cannot be denied that such provocation to develop healing powers in the etheric body of the human being, or of higher animals, would constitute a considerable risk to health. The lower animal, on the contrary, will only be stimulated from its inner being to put forth another member by means of its etheric body. If one of the limbs of a crab is severed, the animal cannot at once renew it. But when it casts its shell the next time and arrives at the next transition stage of its life, a stump appears. The second time, the stump grows larger. And if the animal were to cast its shell often enough, the limb would be replaced by a new one. These facts show us that the etheric body must make greater efforts to call forth the inner forces of healing. And in the higher animals, the healing power is still less. If you mutilate a higher animal, it cannot initially bring forth this healing power from out of its etheric body. Yet, the following is true, and I would like to emphasize this point, which is the subject of a major dispute in scientific circles today. If you mutilate an animal and the animal has progeny, the deformities are not transmitted to the offspring. The next generation has, again, the complete parts. When the etheric body carries its qualities over to the offspring, it is again stimulated to form a complete organism. The etheric body of a triton still acts in the same animal. In a crab, it acts only when it casts its shell. In the higher animals, the same phenomenon appears only in the offspring, and there the etheric body replaces what had been mutilated in the previous generation. Therefore, it is essential that we observe such phenomena in nature carefully and step by step. Then it will become clear that the principle of the etheric body's healing forces always applies, even if they only manifest in the succeeding generation, when the offspring of a mutilated animal is born intact and whole. Here we have, as it were, research into the whys and wherefores of the healing powers of the etheric body. We might now ask the question, how is it then that the higher we rise in the animal kingdom, and this applies externally to the human kingdom also, we find that the healing forces of the etheric body have to make greater efforts to manifest themselves. This has to do with the many different ways in which the etheric body can be connected with the physical body. Between the physical body and the etheric body, there may be a more intimate union or a loose one. For example, let us take the triton, in which the severed member is replaced very quickly. Here we must assume a loose connection between the physical body and the etheric body, and this applies in the plant kingdom to a still higher degree. This union, let us say, is such that the physical body is unable to react upon the etheric body, and the latter remains untouched by what happens to the physical body, and is in a certain sense independent of it. Now the nature of the etheric body is that of activity, of generation and growth. It encourages growth up to a certain point. When we cut off a part of a plant or of one of the lower animals, the etheric body is immediately prepared to restore that part, and to that end unfolds all its activities. But what is the reason if it cannot develop all its activities? The reason is to be found in a closer dependence on the physical body. This is the case with the higher animals. There is a much more intimate connection between the etheric body and the physical body. And when the physical body develops its form and organizes the forces of the physical nature, these forces react upon the etheric body. To put it clearly, in the lower animals or the plants, that which is outside does not react on the etheric body, but leaves it untouched, carrying on an independent existence. When we come to the higher animals, reactions of the physical body are imposed upon the etheric body, which adapts itself completely to the physical body. So that if we injure the physical body, we injure the etheric body at the same time. Hence the etheric body has to exercise greater powers, as it has to first heal itself, and then the corresponding member in the physical body. Therefore, in the case of the etheric body of a higher animal, deeper healing forces must be called forth. But what is the connection? Why is the etheric body of a higher animal so dependent upon the forms of the physical body? The higher we advance in animal creation, the more we need to take into account the activity of the astral body, besides that of the etheric and physical body. In the case of the lower animals, the activity of the astral body is extremely limited. For this reason, the lower animals still have so many qualities in common with the plants. The higher we ascend, the more does the astral body come into action. And this action is such that it makes the etheric body subservient to itself. A being such as a plant, which has only physical body and etheric body, has little to do with the external world. Certain stimuli may be exercised upon the plant from outside, but they are not reflected as inner processes. Where an astral body is active, external impressions are reflected in inner experiences. But a being in which the astral body is inactive is more shut off from the external world. The greater the activity of the astral body, the greater is that creature's openness to the outer world. Thus the astral body unites the inner nature of a being with the outer world, and the increasing activity of the astral body brings it about that the etheric body has to use much stronger forces to make injuries good. If we now pass on from the animal to the human being, a new element arises. Man does not simply conform to certain prescribed functions inspired by the astral body, as is the case with the animals, which have, as it were, a course outlined for them in advance, and which live more according to an established program. We could scarcely say of an animal that it is given to excess in relation to its instincts, or that it follows its instincts with more or less moderation. It follows its plan of life, and all its actions are subject to a sort of typical program. But the human being, having risen higher on the ladder of evolution, is able to discern between right and wrong, truth and falsehood, good and evil. He comes into contact with the world outside in countless different ways, and for many purely individual reasons. All these kinds of contact react and make an impression upon his astral body, and as a consequence of the interaction between his astral body and etheric body, both now suffer these reactions. Thus, if a person leads a dissolute life in any respect, it will make an impression on his astral body, which in its turn influences the etheric body. How it will do this will depend upon what has been laid down in the astral body. This will enable us to understand that our etheric body changes in accordance with the kind of life we lead within the boundaries of good and evil, right or wrong, truth or untruth, and so forth. Let us now remember what takes place when a human being passes through the portal of death. We know that the physical body is laid aside, and that the etheric body, now united with the astral body and the capital I, remains. When a certain length of time has elapsed after death, a time which is measured only by days, the etheric body is thrown aside as a second corpse. An extract, however, of the etheric body is left over, and this is taken along and kept permanently. In this extract of the etheric body is contained, as if in an essence, all that has penetrated the etheric body, for example, from a dissolute life, or from true or false thinking, feeling, and action. This is contained in the etheric body, and the human being concerned takes it with him into the period up to a new birth. As an animal does not have such experiences, it cannot, of course, take anything over in the same way beyond the portal of death. When a human being comes into existence again through birth, the essence of his previous etheric body now impregnates his new etheric body and permeates its structure. Therefore, in his new existence, the person has in his etheric body the results of what he had experienced in his previous life. And as the etheric body is the builder of an entirely new organization at a new birth, all this now imprints itself on his physical body also. How does this come about? Spiritual investigation shows us that in the form of a human body, which enters into existence through birth, we are able to see approximately what a person did in a previous life. But will we also find a really reasonable explanation for what we established as diminishing healing power in the ascending forms of animal species? In the case of an animal, we cannot say that at its birth it brings with it a reincarnated individuality from a previous earth life. Only the common astral body of this species of animal is active, and this will limit the healing power of the etheric body of this animal. In contrast, we find that in the case of the human being, not only his astral body, but also his etheric body is impregnated with the results of the deeds of his previous life. And as the etheric body has within itself the power to bring forth what it formerly had, we shall also understand that this etheric body will also build into the new organism that which it brings with it from previous incarnations. Now we understand how our deeds in one life can work over into our state of health in the next life, and how in our state of health we have often to seek a karmic effect of our previous life's deeds. We may approach the matter in yet another way. We may ask, quote, does everything that we do in the life between birth and death react in the same manner on our etheric body? Close quote. Even in ordinary life, we can perceive a great difference in our inner organization between the reaction of what we experience as conscious beings and many other experiences. Here we are dealing with an extremely interesting fact, which can be fully explained by spiritual science, but can also be understood with ordinary powers of reason. In the course of his life, a person has a great number of experiences which he receives consciously and unites with his capital I. Within him, they develop into mental representations which he works upon, etc. But just think of the infinite number of experiences and impressions which never actually develop into mental representations and are nevertheless part of us and affect us. It will often happen that someone says to you, quote, I saw you in the street today, you even looked at me, close quote, and you know nothing about it. It is a common experience. Of course, this has made an impression. Your eyes indeed saw the other person, but the immediate impression did not develop into a mental image. There are countless impressions of this sort. So that our life is really divided into two parts, into a realm of soul life, which consists of conscious mental images, and another realm that we have never brought really into clear consciousness. But there are further differences. you will easily be able to distinguish between impressions which you have had in your life and can remember, and those which you cannot remember. Thus our soul life is divided into entirely different categories, and there is indeed a very considerable difference between these various categories if we consider the effect upon the inner being of man. Let us now dwell for a while on the life of the human being between birth and death. First of all, we observe this great difference between the mental images which can emerge in our consciousness again and again, and those which have been forgotten, and in relation to which the ability of being recalled has not actually developed. This difference can be most easily exemplified by the following. Think of an impression which called forth a clear idea or mental image within you. Let it be an impression which aroused joy or pain, an impression which was accompanied by a feeling. Let us bear in mind that most impressions, really all the impressions that are made upon us, are accompanied by feelings, and these feelings express themselves not only on the conscious surface of life, but work deeply into the physical body. You need only remember how one impression will cause us to become pale, and another causes us to blush. These impressions affect the circulation of the blood. And now, let us pass over to what, on the whole, does not come to consciousness, or only fleetingly so, and is not remembered. Spiritual science shows us that such impressions are nonetheless accompanied by emotions in the same way as the conscious ones. If you receive an impression from the outer world, which, if received consciously, would have frightened you so much that it would have made your heart pound, that same impression will still affect you, even if it is received unconsciously. It not only makes an impression, but it also works into the physical body. It is remarkable that an impression, which produces a conscious idea or mental image, finds a kind of resistance when working into the deeper human organization. But if the impression simply acts upon us without our bringing it to a conscious idea, then nothing hinders it, but that renders it no less effective. Our human life is very much richer than what actually reaches our consciousness. In the entire period from birth until the time when memory begins, we receive an infinite number of rich impressions, which all stay within us, and which change us in the course of that period. They work into the human being in the same way as the conscious impressions, but there is nothing opposed to them, especially when they are forgotten. Nothing that is otherwise contained in the soul life in the way of conscious mental images can thereby form a dam, as it were, and the subconscious impressions are those which act most profoundly. Life itself provides us with many examples which fully confirm that there are moments in the life of a human being when the second type of inner effect is manifested. We all experience things in our lives which we find hard to understand. There are many situations which leave you wondering why on earth you had to go through them when you did. For example, some impression or other might move you in a way that seems utterly incomprehensible, and makes you wonder why such a relatively insignificant experience could shock you that much. If you looked into the matter, you might find that during that critical period, between birth and the time to which our memory extends back, you had a similar experience, which was, however, forgotten. You have not retained any picture of it which you could call to mind. The impression at the time was shocking. This lives on, and now merges with the present impression, which it reinforces. And what would otherwise have moved or shocked you a lot less, now leaves a particularly potent impression. Once this becomes clear to you, you will grasp the infinitely great responsibility involved in bringing up a child in its earliest years. You will understand how everything will cast its shadow or light into the subsequent life of the individual concerned in a most significant manner. In this way, something of an earlier stage of life works into the later stages of that life. Now, it may turn out that such impressions received in childhood, especially if they recurred frequently, affect the individual's entire disposition towards life. For example, a person might succumb to a depressed mood, which is inexplicable and can only be explained by looking back to find out what kind of impressions from an earlier period are throwing their lights or shadows into the individual's later life. For it is these which now manifest as depression. It will, furthermore, turn out that events which did not just pass the child by, but left a strong impression on him even then, will have a particularly strong effect. In other words, when impressions that are later forgotten strongly involved the feeling life, these strong emotions and intense feelings will be especially effective in calling forth similar experiences later on. You may remember what I have said on various occasions about life during the time of Kamaloka. After the etheric body has been cast aside as a second corpse, the human being lives through his entire life in reverse order, reliving everything he experienced in that last life. What he thus experiences leaves him by no means indifferent. Especially during the period of Kamaloka, that which is lived through engenders very profound feelings, as the human being still possesses his old astral body. Let us assume, for instance, that somebody died at the age of 70 and lives his life backward to his 40th year. When he struck someone in the face, he then experiences the pain he caused the other. This produces a kind of self-reproach. From this, the person retains a longing which he takes with him into his next life, a longing to make good this deed in his next life. You will understand that due to such astral experiences between death and a new birth, our experiences of outer actions are imprinted all the more deeply and unfailingly into our inner being and affect the constitution of our new body. In other words, if in ordinary life we can be touched so strongly by certain experiences, especially in the case of impressions on our feeling life, that our state of mind is adversely affected, we will understand that the very much more intense impressions received during Kamaloka can work right down into the structure of the physical body in a new incarnation. This is an accentuated form of a phenomenon which you may already observe in life between birth and death, provided that you look carefully. Impressions which meet with no hindrance through consciousness will tend to lead to irregularities in the soul, neurasthenia, various kinds of nervous disorders, even mental illness at times. All these phenomena clearly point us to causal connections between earlier and later events. Developing this concept further, we can say that our deeds in one life will be transformed into a powerful emotion after death. This emotion, which is not diluted now by any mental image involving the physical body, by no ordinary consciousness, as the brain is not necessary for this, and which is now experienced through the other, deeper form of consciousness, brings it about that our deeds and the total quality of our being in our previous life are now reflected in our disposition and physical structure in a new life. We will understand that a person inclined to self-centeredness in his thinking, feeling, and willing during his last incarnation will be suffused with powerful emotions against his earlier deeds when confronted with the fruits of his egotistical thinking, feeling, and willing after death. This is indeed the case. He will develop certain inner tendencies which are directed against his own being. And insofar as such tendencies have been produced by the quality of egotism in his previous life, they will be expressed in a weak organization in the next. By, in quotes, weak organization, I am referring to the inner nature, not the outward impression. We need to be clear about the fact that a weak organization can be traced back karmically to egotism in a previous life. Let us go further. Let us suppose that in one life a person manifests a particular tendency toward telling lies. This is indeed a tendency which originates in deeper layers of the soul. For if a person is guided only by what is in his clearest consciousness, he will not really lie. It is only emotions and feelings which work up out of his subconscious which lead him to this. It is a question of something more deep-seated. If a person is untruthful, the actions which proceed from untruthfulness will again arouse the most forcible feelings against himself in the life after death, and a marked inclination against lying will emerge. He will then bring with him into his next life not only a weak organization, but, so spiritual science shows, an organization which is incorrectly built, so to speak, and which manifests irregularly formed inner organs in the finer organization. Something is not quite balanced, and this is due to the earlier tendency to lying. And where did this tendency to lying itself come from? After all, in that tendency, the person already possesses something which is irregular. We need to go back further still to answer this question. Spiritual science shows that a life which knows neither devotion nor love, a superficial life in one incarnation, expresses itself in the tendency to lying in the next incarnation. And in the third incarnation, this tendency to lying manifests itself in incorrectly formed organs. Thus we can karmically trace the effects in three consecutive incarnations: superficiality and unsteadiness in the first incarnation, the tendency to lying in the second, and the physical disposition to illness in the third incarnation. This shows us how karma is connected with health and illness. At the beginning of this lecture, we dealt with the most obvious facts, the healing forces of plants' etheric bodies. We then showed how the astral body, which the animal possesses in addition to the etheric, renders the latter less effective. We further learned that the astral body, which in the ascending order of animal species only inhibits the healing forces, affords something new to the human being through carrying the I, which enables the development of an individual life within the boundaries of good and evil, truth and falsity, the karmic effects on health and illness that originate in man's individual life. In the case of the plant, there are no inner causes of illness, because illness is still something outside, and the etheric healing forces work unhindered. In the lower animals, the etheric body's healing forces still work to the extent where certain parts can be restored. But the higher we ascend, the more strongly the astral body imprints itself into the etheric body, thereby limiting the etheric body's healing forces. Yet, as the animal does not propagate through reincarnation, the content of the animal's etheric body is not associated with any moral, intellectual, or individual qualities, but rather with the general type of the species. However, in the case of the human being, that which he experiences in his I, in the period between birth and death, works right down into the etheric body. Why do the experiences of childhood, in relation to the effects on the feeling life described, only manifest as lighter forms of illness? Because much of what emerges in the form of neurasthenia, neurosis, hysteria, and so forth is caused by things that happened during the same life. However, the causes of more severe forms of illness must be sought in one or the other previous incarnation. because whatever is experienced morally and intellectually can only be fully implanted in the etheric body on passing over to a new birth. On the whole, the human etheric body cannot embody the deeper moral activities in one life, although we shall still hear of exceptional cases, and indeed of very important ones. Such is the connection which exists between our life of good or evil, our moral and intellectual life in one incarnation, and our state of health or illness in the next. The end of Lecture 3.